Hello and welcome back to Unseen Incidents. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten, and on this week's episodes, we're talking the contenders for the Champions League with Real Madrid and Barcelona, plus our dark horses.
That is a good squad, and this is a soft reset in the middle of the season that kind of frees him up. He's pretty much just got to pick his best squad and in its most functional format. And in a tournament like the Champions League, for me, that kind of feels like a setup for short-term success.
Yeah, it's not bad, is it? All it takes is like Kvaratskhelia to go supernova for 45 minutes, and suddenly you're like, oh shit, we're in the semi. Then we've got the burn book. As we speak, he is pissing blood somewhere in Africa.
Yeah,
because I saw the thing today where I was like, oh, you're pissing blood again, are you, fella? Do you know what? That's the God's way of telling you that you're a fucking moron. When blood is coming out of your fucking penis, stop running. While over on the subscription side, we're talking about Arsenal and Bayern Munich's chances at the European Cup. Arsenal need to come back after Christmas and they need to play 7 great defensive games. Well, if they can get like Saliba and Rice on the pitch for most of those, they've got a shot of doing that. You're going to have to get some luck probably, or you're going to have your attack save you in other games. But that's kind of what you need. That's what we're talking about to win the Champions League. And this is a defence which currently looks like maybe the best in Europe. It's the best defence in the best league in Europe. And discussing our favourite video game series ever in anything but football. That's all on this week's episodes of Unseen Incidents. So we're back again for another 2 episodes. Pete, how are you doing, my friend? You're drying a fitted curtain, a fitted sheet on the door behind you. I've got one behind me as well.
This podcast is nothing if not aesthetic. But no, I'm good. I'm good. How are things with you, Patrick?
Oh, good, man. It's been quite a stressful day because I'm still sorting out moving house, but also I'm in the loft. And I went downstairs this morning because it was Emma's turn to get up with a baby. And she was like, I don't want to alarm you, but something happened this morning. So she'd come up to the loft to get a dress that had been like, you know, because our drying hangs up in the loft. She'd come up here to get a dress that had been folded on the bed. And she was like, I put it on and I felt something weird, like at my side. And then a fucking wasp fell out of the dress and had stung her in the side.
What?
It had just been like a sleepy, like massive, but like unseasonal wasp.
Like hibernating wasp.
Had just been
wasp.
Like sleeping in. Yeah, exactly. And to be honest, I've also seen 2 wasps in here recently in the loft. So I'm really not a fan of wasps. This is like, wasps are probably my major phobia.
They're dickheads.
I can't cope with them. Yeah, they're dickheads.
All wasps are dickheads.
But even the bees that look like wasps, I don't care for. I'm like, get away. Like when something buzzes past my ear, I cannot cope with it.
No, I'm kind of fine. I'm fine with bees. Bees are much nicer than wasps. They're much
okay,
less
but like
hornets, they're fucking bastards as well. Hornets are terrifying.
Well, some of them are, but some of them are chill because they're like, you know, like a really big hench guy has nothing to prove. I feel like some hornets are like that. But anyway, I mean, I just can't get in. I can't deal with the wasp situation. But I think it's after wasp bedtime now, so. You know, I think we're okay. But on the plus side, I hate the people buying my house. So I'm sort of like, fingers crossed, maybe
there's a wasp nest somewhere
in this. I mean, I don't think there are quite enough to suggest that. But if there were, it would be very funny. And maybe one day, you know, I'll just be walking past and I'll see like 2 people running out of the house, like surrounded by wasps. That'd be very funny.
Not to burst your bubble here, but I learned this summer that wasps almost never return to a nest that's previously been used. So unless they were to set up a new nest in your loft, they wouldn't return to one that's already set up, unfortunately for you and your wishes to cause pain on your your new buyers.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. It is unfortunate. But, you know, I could probably do something else in this house.
Mm.
Just like leave the gas on.
I do have a running theory that there is no bigger dickhead in the world than the person who previously owned your house.
Yeah,
because the shit you find after you buy a house, like even years into owning a house, just the shit you find whenever you need to do a bit of work, whenever something breaks and you kind of go, you venture into a like a a cupboard or the back or through a wall, whatever, that you've never been before, and you see the inside of the house. You see like the inner workings that's been patched up. Some of the stuff that your previous owners do are fucking mental. When we did our extension, we had to dig up like the back garden, and we just found like essentially they used it as a rubbish tip and then covered over it. There was like a rolled up carpet and shit, and then they just decked over it. They pretty much just shoved a load of crap. Instead of taking it to the dump, they just shoved it on the ground and then put decking over it.
What, like when they're like...
And then lived there.
That's like when they're doing archaeology and they're like, oh, you know, the Romans just chucked a bunch of shit over here. Like, what are they doing?
Mental arseholes.
I kind of like the idea of treating like the earth as you know, the one cupboard in your house that's full of crap and it's like jammed in there. Yeah, super just... tight. But no, I agree. I saw a tweet about this once that was just like, it was something like, there will never be like a bigger scumbag than the person who owns your house before you. And it ended with, you honorless fuck. And I was just like, it is true. Like, no one, they never buy like a brand name boiler that can be fixed by a normal person. They buy a boiler that is like made, you know, by like a guy down the road who thinks that he can approximate it from like somebody else's loose description of a boiler, and it takes filters that can only be bought in like one region of China, and you're
or
just like,
or discontinued.
Oh, right. Yeah. And then they're just like, oh, and you know, to decorate it, we just like spackled it with asbestos or something. and you're like, oh, cool, right? That's a fun problem for me to solve. Like, we didn't have a working water stopcock in our house. It was like, well, what you do is you find this pipe and then you sort of like feel your way down it in the dark because you can't really see it. And then you try and put a screw in this and then you turn it like that. And we were like,
that's mental.
We're just going to put a handle on that, like that, like normal people.
So basically, if a pipe bursts in your house, you would just accept that it floods.
We had a pipe burst in our house, or not burst, but like back up a month after we moved in, and water was pouring through the ceiling of our bedroom. And we were running around like, how the fuck do we turn the water off? It was an absolute shit show. But like, yeah. So I don't know. It's all fun. It's all fun, I would say. Can't complain. You know, I have a house. It's nice to have one. It's full of wasps.
Like, you say you can't complain, but we've just spent 5 minutes complaining. But I get it.
I know, but like, I am that good, Pete. Like, there's a situation where technically I should not be able to complain, and yet I'm doing it. Today, we're talking Champions League, because the Champions League, I think, is unusually interesting, the last year of it being normal. But I think we all agree that Man City are the top contenders for the Champions League. Boring.
Mm-hmm.
But once you say, who's the second team in the Champions League? Like, who are the second best team? If Man City go out, who are the favourites? I don't think it's very simple. I think if you ask the average person who's maybe not paying that much attention, they'd be like, well, obviously like Real Madrid or like Bayern Munich or something. But while those teams are in the conversation, I don't think either one of them is the clear like second place candidate. I think there are big question marks over Real Madrid domestically. There are big question marks about Bayern Munich's kind of depth in certain positions. But generally speaking, there are question marks about every team except Manchester City, which is why I don't think we have a clear second place team. So on this side this week, we're going to talk about Real Madrid. We're going to talk about Barcelona. And we're going to have our own kind of niche picks for teams who we think could get kind of interesting in the Champions League. And then over on the subscription side, we're going to take a look at Arsenal and Bayern Munich, who I think are perhaps, you know, two of the ones that our listeners might be most interested in hearing about. So where should we start? Which team should we start with of those ones? Because instinct says Real Madrid.
Yeah, I get the feeling that you want to start with Real Madrid, more to the point that you said, you didn't say that you wanted to start with Real Madrid before we started recording, but you heavily indicated that you are more interested in Real Madrid. So did you want to start with Real Madrid? We can start with Real Madrid.
I think we should start with Real Madrid, because I do think that, like, despite the fact that Barcelona obviously won the title last year, and have got really promising youngsters and have some interesting parts. And I think, you know, the general perception across Europe is that Real Madrid are the stronger squad, the stronger team, the team that are on the right trajectory. Barcelona have kind of got good by airlifting in Robert Lewandowski and by kind of getting lucky with a crop of youngsters coming along at the same time. And we are going to talk about these youngsters. They deserve to be talked about. But Real Madrid have been slowly building an incredibly deep squad of pre-peak, super talented players who probably only need one or two parts to round them out. You know, they're talking about a left back. We're hearing talk about Alphonso Davies. Well, they talk about right back as well. We're hearing talk about Reece James. And then obviously the question of what they do up front is still open. But I think that this perception of Real Madrid doesn't really tally with reality. They're second in Spain at the moment to Girona, which is kind of amazing.
Yeah.
But they're above Atletico and they're above Barca. But across Europe, if you look at their expected goal difference per 90, they're 15th. They're between Newcastle and Marseille. And they're in, honestly, a terrible league. Like, there are a couple of teams that are okay. Girona are kind of lucky to be where they are, but they're pretty good. Sociedad are pretty good. Athletic Club are okay. But like Sevilla are garbage this season. Like it's not a vintage like league season in Spain. And Real Madrid's numbers are, they're kind of like a 0.7, 0.8 plus 0.7, 0.8 expected goals per 90 team. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, Arsenal are at 0.1. Arsenal are at 1. And I don't think Arsenal have been especially great. Like Man City are at about, I think, 1.3, something like this. Inter Milan are at 1.3, 1.4. So I just don't quite know what's going on with them, basically. I have my ideas, but I don't know. Like, what's your take on Real Madrid generally? Do you have opinions? Because it feels like right now we're all just kind of like, we're only talking about Bellingham. And after that, and the assumption is, well, Bellingham's playing well and Real Madrid are winning, and therefore they must be, you know, Real Madrid. But I don't really think they are.
Yeah, I mean, it is a bit of a weird one, because they're not the only team that you kind of look at and you think the sum of their parts are theoretically great. But when you see it on the pitch, or when you see them playing at the minute, it just seems like something's missing. And I suppose it is kind of weird that Bellingham is kind of blowing everything out of the water. And I think he's La Liga's top goal scorer at the minute. I think he's got 10 goals, which is mental. But
yeah, it's crazy.
Outside of Bellingham, I look at the squad, and like you say, there are great pre-peak players there, but I'm not convinced about a few of them. I'm not convinced about their forward line. They've lost Benzema, and I know we've spoken about it before in previous episodes, but they haven't necessarily really replaced him. And not that you necessarily need to replace him like for like, but when I look at, say, the Madrid team that won 3 in a row, the Zidane Madrid team, you know what that team is. You know where all your goals are coming from. You know that you can absolutely trust on 4 or 5 players to give you like 7 out of 10s every game throughout the tournament. And it kind of feels like Bellingham's overperformance, and it is a massive overperformance and completely unsustainable. Like this will not continue. He will come back down to earth. And when you look at the results and take, say, Bellingham's influence out of it, if he, obviously this is a big if, but if he wasn't there, who would step up? Where would they be without him, really? And my biggest concern with them is what happens when he comes back down to earth, and where do their numbers go? Where do their result? How do their results go? And where do their kind of big moments, big goals, big results, who makes a difference there when Bellingham kind of levels off? Because Bellingham can still be the best player in the league or top 4 players in the league. And his output would probably be at 60% of what it is now, maximum. Like, it is an outrageous output that he currently has. So my biggest concern is kind of, once he comes back down to earth, what is the actual real iteration, the real version of Real Madrid? And I think outside of City, I think they probably are the second best team in the Champions League.
Don't think they are at all.
I think they have the highest ceiling in that squad. If they can make it work.
I don't think that's true either.
You don't? What are your reservations about Real Madrid squad then?
Well, partially it's what you're saying. Like, where are the goals coming from? Like, okay, they've scored the second most goals for Atleti domestically, but they're third for XG. Okay, fine. And they've been getting kind of lucky on both ends. To be honest though, before the season, I remember us talking about them and we were kind of like, right, well, they don't have a centre forward. And they went in and got Joselu. And he's been great in La Liga. He really has. But I don't think he's going to be a difference maker against the best teams in the Champions League. Like, I don't really see Joselu like making a difference against Manchester City in a way that Benzema used to.
No.
So to me, and I definitely said this like before the season started, the best way for this team to be elite was for it to use its incredible roster of midfielders to just play shut down defense. You know, just you cannot get anything. You cannot get anything. And then run, like, run the attack just through Vinny and Rodrigo and say, do something. And I think that's actually a good recipe in the Champions League. Like, maybe not quite as good domestically, because teams are always going to shell against Real Madrid and you are going to need extra numbers. Now, Bellingham's been, you know, better attacking-wise, I think, than any of us expected. But as you say, he's got 12 goal involvements from 6 XG. That's still amazing. Like, that still suggests that over the course of a season, you'd expect to get like 20 goal involvements. And because he's way out over his skis, he's going to blitz that, you'd imagine.
Yeah.
But the rest of the attack hasn't quite been there. Like, looking at their numbers, Rodrigo and Vinny look okay. Like, Vinny's got 5 in 9.
Mm-hmm.
Rodrigo's got 6 in 10. But if we were talking about this last week, you know, like before the game against Valencia when they scored 6.
Yeah.
Rodrigo had 2 goal involvements in 9. And Vinny was on 3 and 8. So Vinny got 2 and Rodrigo got 2 goals, 2 assists in that one game. And so that suddenly makes their numbers look much better when actually they haven't quite been at the races. And to be fair, Vinicius has only played about 70% of the available minutes. It seems like his constant victimization by fans and by officials in that league is maybe taking a toll on him, completely understandably. But he is down last year from 0.6 expected goals per 90. He's down to 0.5. Rodrigo is down to 0.6 from 0.75.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Bellingham's at 0.6, which is great, but that is still not like great striker level. Bellingham can continue to score at a high rate, but it's still not quite the same as having an elite striker, right? Because 0.6 XG is amazing for an attacking mid. It'd be amazing for a winger, but for a centre forward, it would only be good or very good. I don't know. And Real Madrid don't have a centre forward on top of Bellingham and Vinicius and Rodrigo. Bellingham is what they have kind of instead of a centre forward. At least that's how I conceive of it in the Champions League, where I do think they will mostly play the diamond midfield with Bellingham at the tip and then Valverde, Camavinga, or maybe Modric, though he hasn't played much, maybe Kroos and Tchouaméni.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of thought they would play ugly defensive football and that would actually be kind of smart in the Champions League. And that may still happen because Ancelotti, you know, is a smart guy and that is, he normally puts together his talent in the most sensible way. And I do think that is the most sensible way. But right now, as an attacking side, they're decent. 1.8 XG per 90, that's fine. It's not nothing special. Defensively, they're only okay. Like 1.1 XG against per 90. Like Barcelona's defense is better. Atletico's defense is better. Tons of the teams in the Champions League have better defenses. And again, are playing in tougher leagues. Like Arsenal have a better defense, playing in a much tougher league. I think Newcastle have got a better defense and playing in a much tougher league and have had a tough schedule. So I just kind of look at this and I think I completely buy. If the argument is Real Madrid will put this talent together in a way that when it gets to March, no one's going to want to play them and they'll be super dangerous. I think that is I agree with that. I think that is probably what will happen. But based on their performances right now, are Real Madrid the second best team in the competition? No. They're not even the second best team in Spain on current form. Like, I think Atleti have been better. I think Barca have been better. Real Madrid are actually second in Spain. Like, I just think that they're not playing particularly well. And the fact that Bellingham is playing out of his skin is kind of skewing everyone's perception of how good Real Madrid can be. Because what they don't have is like a guy coming back from injury who, you know, might explode. Like there are other teams we're going to talk about where we say, well, what is the path for them to be amazing?
Yeah, yeah.
It's this guy getting fit again.
Yeah.
You know, these players staying on the pitch.
Yeah.
There are yeah, exactly. There are tons of teams where we're like, basically they need to not get any injuries and continue playing like this, or they need this guy to get fit again. With Real Madrid, it's kind of like Bellingham continues to overperform. Vinicius and Rodrigo get back to last season's levels. The whole defense improves as well. Like there's quite a lot of improvement that needs to be done across the board at both ends of the pitch. And I don't doubt that that can happen. It could easily happen. You know, they're adapting to a new style, but it's a lot of ifs, you know, it's a lot of conjecture. Like, well, if they could do this and if they could do that and if they could do that. Now, we may all think that those things are likely because it's Real Madrid and it's Carlo Ancelotti, but when you've got like 3 ifs on the table, you're in a worse position than somebody who's got 2 ifs on the table or 1 if on the table. And some of these teams, I think, have 1 or 2 ifs on the table. And Real Madrid, I think, have got maybe 3. So certainly I'm not writing them off. I think that'd be insane. Yeah. But it's not like they're saying we're going to go and buy a striker in January.
No, it's not.
And I don't think Endrick arrives until next summer, I think. So I have, you know, I have kind of question marks about...
And I think that's all fair. And okay, some other teams that will come on to have maybe slightly less ifs. They may have one less if, but I kind of think that a three, say for hypothetical sake, Real Madrid have three ifs. But with Real Madrid's squad and with specifically Ancelotti, specifically yeah. in the Champions League, like if there is one mm-hmm. team and one manager to make something work in one competition, Real Madrid, Ancelotti, Champions League. Like those are the three.
I agree.
Kind of like levelers. Because we saw it last season with Camavinga at left back. We've seen Ancelotti adapt to game scenarios, selection issues, load management. We've seen him adapt incredibly well across his career, but like specifically in this Madrid squad, with this Madrid squad. I'm not that concerned about that. I'm not concerned about Madrid finding form. I'm not concerned about Madrid playing better. I'm not concerned about Bellingham kind of dropping off. Although I suppose this is tied in with my concern. Bellingham dropping off, that, you know, you should be able to manage large parts of that. My concern is that I don't know who's going to grab their goals. Who's going to be their goal scorer this year in terms of their biggest output, finishing most of their chances.
Yeah, exactly.
The Benzema hole. You know, Joselu's got, what, 5 goals this season in...
He's got like 7 goal involvements in seven games. Yeah, like he's actually been unreal.
He's played 660 minutes and got 7 goal involvements. That's great. That was unbelievable, actually. Fair play to him. But then Rodrigo, 3 goal involvements in 1,000 minutes. Sorry, in 900 minutes. 3 goals, sorry. 6 goal involvements. Like, you look at those Vinicius, Rodrigo, Joselu. Who's going to step up and get 20 goals all comps, 25 goals all comps? I don't really see either of them doing that.
Well, they don't need to do that, though, right? Like, I mean, in the Champions League, the Diamond and Vinicius Rodrigo do something is like a perfectly legit strategy.
Sure.
You know, like that is a nightmare for teams to play against. Like if you're a heavy possession team like Bayern, Arsenal, Manchester City, the last thing you want to come up against is Real Madrid, where they're like, we've got a bunch of the most incredible two-way central midfielders in the world, and we've got two of the most explosive wingers in the game.
Yeah.
And you're going to come and try and attack us, and we're going to punch a hole through the middle of you, and we're going to have like Vinicius up against your right back 100 times a game.
Yeah. I do feel that a lot of this comes down to how well Vinicius plays this season.
Yeah,
I agree. I think pretty much that could be, once Bellingham comes off his heater, I think the difference between Real Madrid potentially going deep in the Champions League and going out in the round of 16 is literally how good Vinicius is and how much he can influence their attacking phase of play, how many goal involvements he can get in the Champions League. I think it's almost as simple as that. Because when you look through that squad, in terms of the final third, in terms of consistently influencing goal involvement, goal creation, goal scoring numbers, the one guy I would look towards in that squad is Vinicius. And it's kind of as simple as that for me. Benzema is gone, so it's now, you know, it's Vinicius's burden to carry. And I think he's been doing fine this season, but the whole 2 goal involvements in however many games before the Valencia 5-1 win doesn't fill me with a huge amount of optimism.
No,
but
agreed.
It'll be interesting to see how they cope once they kind of settle. Once the kind of dust settles around this fucking Bellingham explosion, I think having a little bit more involvement and a little bit more, more shine on him, once the shine wears off Bellingham a bit, I think that'd probably help him. But like you say, it could just be a tough spot for him in terms of everything that's happening outside of just football, like all of the treatment he's had, etc., over the past 3, 4, 5 seasons.
Yeah.
I don't know, but it's a lot of pressure on him, I think, personally, because basically for me, breaking it down, if he plays well and gets a heavy amount of goal involvements, Real Madrid are good. If he doesn't, then Real Madrid aren't that good.
I mean, this is basically where we are. Like, it's one of those things where, like, in the past, it felt like Real Madrid had 5 or 6 guys who, if they were great, they'd be fine. And this season, because they didn't buy a forward, it's not quite as strong as that. And that's fine. Like, we expected it to be that way. We were like, okay, they didn't get the forward they wanted this summer. And it's not a criticism, really. We were just like, you don't get the forward you want, you decide to wait a year. That's a perfectly good strategy. But you accept then that you're probably going to be a little bit scrappy. you're going to be a little bit more, you're going to have to get on the defensive end what you're not getting on the attacking end. Right now, they're not getting that. So either somebody needs to step up in attack and do something, and there aren't that many people who could do that because Bellingham's currently doing it and Real Madrid are still not playing that well.
Yeah.
Or the defence gets a lot better. And I think there are definitely gains to be made in the defence. But I don't know, should we move on to Barcelona? Because I do think that Barcelona's situation is quite interesting context for Real Madrid. Because I think if you said Barcelona are contenders, if Barcelona won the Champions League, I do think everyone would say, wow, that's crazy. Because the perception is that they're not that good. And to be fair, I don't think they're that good. I just don't really rate them that much. I don't know, like, to put it in context, like, their expected goal difference per 90 is like plus 1.02, and Real Madrid's is plus 0.77. So about a quarter of an expected goal per 90 difference between their performances and Real Madrid's performances. So they've got a better attack than Real Madrid and a better defense than Real Madrid domestically.
Yeah.
Okay. And while people could say, well, you know, it's domestic football and Real Madrid in the Champions League, it's like, well, also though, in the Champions League, that Real Madrid have not been that good either. Like, Real Madrid's expected goal difference per 90 in the Champions League is plus 1.04, which is very good, but Barcelona's is plus 1.18. Again, Real Madrid have Napoli in their group, blah, blah, blah. But still, you know, Barcelona have been better than them, in inverted commas, in both competitions. And I don't think that's a great situation for Madrid, because I think this Barcelona squad is weird. I don't think it's particularly well coached. I don't really rate Xavi. I don't know, maybe he's fine. But it's interesting to me that Xavi always talks in press conferences about playing Barcelona football and like pass and move and all this shit. And actually, when you watch Barcelona, you're like, Christ, this is plodding, like pragmatic. I mean, for all football, I guess you could argue it's pragmatic to one degree or another. But, you know, it's just like, it is like absolutely get the job done football. I don't know, like, what are your thoughts on Barcelona? Because I feel like I've spent the last 10 years talking about Barcelona and they're just annoying. They're annoying to me.
Yeah, I largely agree with most of that, because it seems like a weird juxtaposition, I suppose. Like, if you look at their underlying numbers, if you looked at them in isolation, they're not bad. Like, they seem pretty decent. You know, they're the best in La Liga for expected goals. They're ninth in Europe. They're ninth in Europe for expected goal difference per 90. Like, above Juve, above Liverpool, above Arsenal. They're technically top of their group in the Champions League, albeit, you know, same points, same goal difference as Porto, and statistically the weakest group. But if you look at it in isolation, you're like, okay, this seems like a team that are pretty decent, that could feasibly go reasonably deep in Champions League and probably will be fairly close to a title or fairly close to the title at the end. But in reality, I kind of think it's quite a bit further from that, because everything kind of just seems a little bit flat overall. It kind of seems just a little bit, I don't really know what to make of them. Because for me, the two biggest concerns I have is that they look, one, like they have a lack of creativity, and two, that they haven't finished that well. They should be creating better and they should be finishing better. You know, of their 12 wins in the league this year, in all comps this year, 9 have been by a single goal, and they've only scored more than 2-4 times. So for me, 9 1-goal wins, those can change on anything. Like, that, you're not necessarily controlling a game. That's not comfortable. And this was a problem last season as well. You know, last season, they equaled a record of 1-0 wins in a single campaign with 11. So this has been a thing for a long time.
Damn.
That for a season and almost a season and a half now, I don't want to say they've gotten lucky, because you kind of make your own luck, whatever, but they've been winning games by narrow margins consistently. And it kind of feels that if you're winning that regularly, that narrowly, you're vulnerable, because you're not controlling games. There's very few blowouts. This season, they've only scored more than 2-4 times. And I look at them and I just think there could be so much more, but they're just flat. Lewandowski himself said last season that Barca need to be better at creating chances and scoring goals. And I suppose there could be a number of reasons for it. And one of the main reasons, I think, is the tactical switch that Xavi made halfway through last season, where he essentially ditched his wingers and went for four-man midfield. And
yeah,
they outside of that, what was it, the Super Cup game, the 3-1 win against Real, where they were incredible. I think generally they've looked worse for it. And when you bring in a player like Lewandowski, for example, you bring him in, all you're doing, you bring him in to score a ton of goals. And whether you should cater your entire team to a 35-year-old is here nor there. But I think you should put him in the best position to score the most amount of goals. That's, in my opinion, you're going to be a better team for that when you buy a player like Lewandowski. That's what you get. Mm-hmm. And there's no point buying him at that age with that type of player archetype and then trying to make him something else. It doesn't make sense. So you play to his game. And this four-man midfield system has had a very significant negative effect on Lewandowski, because Lewandowski, for his entire career, pretty much has always outperformed his expected goals. That's just kind of him. He's an elite finisher. And yeah, sure, he spent a long time in the Bundesliga, which might have beefed his numbers a little bit in terms of his ability to score and his ability to finish chances versus the expected conversion rate of that chance. I think only one season, I think it's in the Bundesliga, that he actually scored less than his expected goals. And he continued that when he landed at Barca, and everything was kind of good. Everything was looking good. And then Xavi changed. And since Xavi changed that system, Lewandowski has steadily declined in terms of his expected goals versus his actual goals. And since Xavi changed the system, his expected goals are now more than his actual goals. So this season, Lewandowski's minus 0.8 goals to expected goals ratio, bottom 30 in the league. And after 10 games this season, so 3 games ago, he was at minus 1.2, which was the second worst in Barca squad behind Joao Felix. And
sure, but like that, but all you need is to like score 2 goals in a game, sure, and it'll probably like fix that.
That is fair, but it's not that he's not scoring, right? So he is Barca's top goal scorer. He's got 10 goal involvements, 11 games, 12 goal involvements, 14 games, all comps. That's fair. Right, like he's scoring. Only 3 players in the league have scored more than him. But he is and has declined and continued to decline. If you look at him last season, after 15 league games, he had 13 goals and 4 assists. So he was averaging, he was a little over 1 goal involvement a game, almost a goal, or a goal involvement a game, and almost a goal per game. This season, he's just under a goal involvement per game and at like 0.6 goals per game. So he's still contributing significantly, but he is he is declining. And
well, I think the issue that I see is that like you can limit a player, and we'll talk about this when we get to Harry Kane. You can actually limit. I don't quite agree with what you were saying about like you change a player. Like it depends what you mean. If you mean try and change what a player is entirely, that's a problem. But if you say to a player, well, we want you to focus on this aspect of your game, I think that's fine. So Bayern have done that with Kane to great effect this season. And so Lewandowski getting fewer touches, I'm kind of okay with, because I don't think that necessarily matters. I think, you know, at his age, he's 34, 35.
35,
like, stick him in the box and give him chances.
That's kind of what they've done.
But he's not getting as many chances. Like, he's, for the last, 10 consecutive seasons, for his entire time at Bayern, he's been over 4 shots a game. And in fact, he's often been close to 5. This season, he's at 3.1. That's his lowest shots per game on record. He's on his lowest shots on target per game on record. Like that is a quite a big deal when he's basically meant to be the guy. However, I kind of do think it's easy to tell a story about like how Barcelona get better, because if you look at their squad list, if you look at the guys who've played most minutes for them this season, here are some players who are not in their 11 most used players this season. Araujo, Ferran Torres, Frankie de Jong, Fermin Lopez, Pedri, Rafinha. Like, none of those guys are among their 11 most used players this season. Whereas, you know, Gundogan has been, Romeo has been. And to me, it just feels like, okay, well, Frankie de Jong is fit and plays every minute. Pedri gets fit and plays every minute. Rafinha plays more minutes. And Araujo plays all the minutes, and that's how this team is better. And you only need like one or two of those guys to get a bit fitter. Like I think we basically agree, right, that if like
we do,
if Pedri came and played every minute, way higher expectations of this Barcelona side.
Yeah, so like you say, basically Lewandowski getting less touches. He said, you're older, stay in the box. We only really need you to influence the game at the very, very final moment. Be fine with that. And he's good. He's a good mm-hmm. enough finisher to do that. But to make that work, you need to create behind him. And you need to have a huge creative force creating those chances for him to finish. Otherwise, you then become flat and your centre forward is isolated and he becomes like a bit part player and his numbers decline. And I think that's what's happening now. And the biggest thing for me, at least in this, is that of that list, Frankie De Jong's obviously a big name, but for me, the biggest name on that list that needs to play more is Pedri. Because for me, Pedri seems to be everything good about Barcelona going forward seems to require Pedri. Pedri seems to make that attacking creation of Barcelona just tick. And the biggest problem is that he just cannot stay fit. Like he's played, what, 5 games this season? He's just come back from 2 months out with
he's played like 280 injury. Minutes, something like that.
Yeah, he played 30 minutes twice in their last 2 games. Maybe,
he started 3, he's appeared in 4 games.
And then I think he's appeared in the Champions League as well once. But basically, he is what makes that attack tick. That sitting in behind Lewandowski, that creation from around the box, he is what makes that tick. And my concern is that, one, how injury prone he's become. 2, how reliant Barcelona are on him, that he needs to play like absolutely as much as he can. And obviously, any team in the world will want their best players to play as many minutes as they physically can. But with Barcelona, it seems a little bit more desperate. I've read reports that insiders have indicated that Barcelona are generally, every time Pedri's injured, Barcelona are kind of pushing him to come back earlier than he might be comfortable with. Like his own personal teams have like essentially elongated his recovery period against Barca's kind of like wishes. Not for the first time as well. So like the injuries he's had over the past couple of years, like they're always pushing him to get back. And it seems like Barcelona and Xavi are like, are you 70% fit? If the answer is yes, we want you to play.
But also they refuse to do the shit that they could do to improve that situation. So to me, like, just play Rafinha. Rafinha's really good.
Sure.
And Rafinha's appeared in 9 games this season, but only has like 390s. He's got fewer minutes than Pedri. But for whatever reason, like, Xavi just
doesn't want to play.
He seems to get these ideas in his head about personnel and then say like, oh, I'm not really sure. You know, like, so he wanted Ferran Torres. Oh, I don't like Ferran Torres. You know, he wanted Aubameyang. Oh, I don't like Aubameyang. He wanted Rafinha. Oh, I'm not sure about Rafinha. But Rafinha, every time he's on the pitch, is kind of amazing for Barca. I mean, look, I can't knock them that much because like Real Madrid have 3 players on over 0.5 XG per 90. I mean, I guess Vinicius is at 0.5, so maybe 4 players. But Barcelona have got like 7. Barcelona have got loads of guys in that zone. You know, they've got like, obviously they've got Pedri and Rafinha, though they haven't played many minutes, but they've got like Lewandowski, Ferran Torres, Joao Felix, Lamine Yamal, Fermin Lopez. They've just got a ton of guys up there. And it just feels like, okay, this is how you look without one of your kind of, you know, 3 or 4 superstars.
Yeah.
Well, if he gets fit, and I think like Xavi starts playing Rafinha again, though I don't know how likely that is, I just think this team could explode because they're already putting up better numbers than Real Madrid. It's easier to tell. With Real Madrid, it feels like narrative and squad, all these things make me want to rate Real Madrid more. And in terms of long-term trajectory, I do. Mm-hmm. I do think Real Madrid will just like add a forward next year and be like, and suddenly streak away. And I don't know if I rate Barcelona for like the Champions League, but Barcelona, if we're just looking at how they are playing right now, Barcelona are playing better against their opposition than Real Madrid and by a long way, like considerably better.
But then,
however, they lose El Clasico and you kind of think, well, isn't this a little bit like last season when Barcelona's numbers also looked great? And then they were like pretty easily put down in the Europa by Man United, who were good, but not great.
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing. Like,
yeah,
last season, the same thing was the case where we were like, wow, Barcelona looking pretty good domestically. And then they just got like knocked out fairly easily, I thought, by Manchester United. And I wonder if that's where they are right now. I wonder if they're like a bit of a flat track bully where like they can absolutely pummel teams in Spain, but they cannot beat the best teams. However, I do want to give them credit for how good they've been. And I do think maybe the difference between them being able to do this against crap teams and good teams is like Pedri. Like, you know, maybe that is it.
I literally think it is, because as good as, or as decent as they've seen, and their underlying numbers are good. And, you know, their underlying numbers are better than Madrid. But if you look at Opta's statistic, like predictions, Real Madrid way higher in terms of like likelihood of reaching the final or the semi-final. And for me, literally, this comes down, much like I said, Real Madrid's season or effectiveness comes down to how good Vinicius plays this year. For me, this is just getting Pedri on the pitch. Because over the past year, Pedri's in the top 7% in Europe for shot creating actions per 90 and top 3% from shot creating actions per 90 from open play. So add that into that team. He makes all of that kind of attacking play tick. You've got Lewandowski, one of the greatest natural goal scorers of his generation, who bagged goals for fun in the Bundesliga, bagged a fair amount of goals last season, is, even without Pedri or with Pedri's limited involvement, is one of the top goal scorers in the league. I think I said only three players have more goals than him.
Yeah.
Once you add that, plus, like you say, players like Rafinha could maybe get more minutes. Fermín López hasn't played that much, but he's been good when he has. He's got three goal involvements in 12 games, all comps. Pretty decent for a 20-year-old in his first legitimate season at the top level. I think last season he was in the third tier of Spanish football.
Like, yeah, he was.
There are a lot of really, really good parts. And one, obviously, Frankie de Jong is also a very, very good part. And then one fucking amazing part in Pedri. And
yeah,
I feel that you just get him, keep him fit. And all of a sudden, you start, one, blowing away teams that are kind of the bottom end of La Liga, or even, I suppose, by that time, they'll be in the knockout stages, sure. But you start blowing away those teams. All of a sudden, those run of 1-0 wins turn into 2-0 and 3-0 wins. You are far more competitive and against like the big juggernaut teams, the kind of absolute El Clasicos, the when you come up against, I don't know, like a Milan or a PSG in the knockouts, you can not get bullied by teams that are kind of not even like as good as you, but like they're thereabouts, tougher games, big occasions. I kind of think that they're not that far away from being very, very good. I'm not sure if they are going to be amazing if they stick with the four-man midfield and if they don't get Pedri. If Pedri doesn't play pretty much every minute, I don't think they're going to be that good.
Yeah.
And the biggest problem is game management with Pedri. They've pretty much said, you're going to play every minute until you get injured, and then we're going to just rinse and repeat.
Well, and if they'd, you know, got good luck instead of like bad luck, and they were currently like top of the league by a few points, then we would probably say, just rest Pedri as much as you can. You know, like you can beat the teams at the bottom of La Liga without Pedri, and make sure Pedri's fit for February when you're going to need him in the knockouts. But because they're stuck in this mass of teams, you know, with Girona and Real Madrid and even Athletic Club and Atletico, obviously.
Girona will fall away, though, I imagine.
They will, but like, they're the
biggest overperformers in Europe currently, per expected.
Yeah, but it's more that I think that Barcelona will look at the number of teams around them and think like, shit, okay, yeah, well, when Pedri's fit, we've got to use Pedri.
Yeah.
Whereas if you were like just super dominant and like 5 points clear, then you'd say,
we can manage it better.
Let him come back slowly.
It's just mental the amount they used him. Like the first season he broke into the senior team at 17. He played 71 games that year. 71 games that season. Sorry, not calendar year, that season, with La Liga, the Euros, and then the Olympics. 2021, he played 71 games. Pretty much rolled through.
I mean, the Olympics is crazy.
But I think that finished, mid-August, and he rolled pretty much straight into the La Liga the second time, like the next season, no rest, and then played 24 games that season and had a big hamstring injury. Shock.
Yeah.
And then the hamstring injury has recurred multiple times since. Shock.
And Barcelona have like a history of doing this. Like the same happened with Ansu Fati, right? Like they were like, Fati is going to be our savior.
Yeah.
Play Fati. Oh, Fati's injured. And basically after that injury, every time he's come back, he's been good briefly, and then he's got injured again.
Yeah.
And you just never see consistent minutes. So, I mean, I don't know. I feel like it sounds like we're on the fence a bit about Barca, because we're like, they're good and there's a way for them to be better, but we also don't really trust they look.
I just don't think Pedri can stay fit. I don't think Barcelona are... I don't think they'll use him intelligently enough for him to stay fit enough, for him to have anywhere near the amount of impact that he could have on this squad over a course of a season.
I also think that we're now at the stage where or we're almost at the stage. Maybe the round of 16 is the last point where this is the case. You don't really need to play in the Champions League the way you play in your league anymore. And Real Madrid's deficiencies, I'm putting that in inverted commas, such as they are not really a problem in the latter stages of the Champions League.
No.
I mean, maybe they are if you draw like a small side who perceives you as like giants that like they're just going to sit back and like defend the whole time and try and win on set pieces, which, you know, there are teams who'll do that. But it's okay to kind of play conservative football and try and win with set pieces and breakaways once you're out of the group stage of the Champions League. But Barcelona don't play that way. Barcelona still push up high, but and they press harder than any team in La Liga. But I also don't think their press is kind of good enough against the elite sides. There are I think, six teams in La Liga that win high turnovers more often than Barcelona, even though Barcelona press more aggressively than anybody else in the league. So I don't think that their press is like super well coached and super effective. And I just think you come up against a side with elite possession players like Real Madrid, Man City, Arsenal, certainly Bayern, like probably a couple of others I'm forgetting. They are going to be able to play around your press. And then I think Barcelona have a seriously soft center. So,
yeah.
All right, Barcelona done with. Should we move on to our dark horses then? Because these are the teams that, I don't know, I guess they might be mentioned in the conversation for the Champions League, but everyone sort of immediately dismisses them.
Mm.
Like, you know, I've mentioned, obviously I've spoken about Arsenal's chances for it and been quite bullish on them. I've spoken about Newcastle's chances and been quite bullish on them. So I decided not to do Newcastle. But I did Inter. Mm-hmm. And to be honest with you, like, I think Inter are just like obvious. I think Inter are clearly the best team in Italy. By quite a long way. They took a long time this season to get to the top of Serie A, but they're there now and they're 2 points clear. And they've got a plus 16.3 expected goal difference, which is nearly four better than the next best team. They're the top scorers in Italy. They've got five goals more than the next best team. They've got the best defence in Italy, six conceded in 12. So they're currently on track for 98 points and a plus 73 goal difference. Now, I don't know if that's going to happen.
That's fairly
I suspect
punchy.
It isn't. But their numbers domestically, they're like a plus 1.4 XG per 90 side, expected goal difference, you know. Yeah. So that's, they create 1.4 XG more than their opponents per game on average. And they are exactly the same in the Champions League. Now, they've had an easy-ish group, Sociedad, Salzburg, Benfica, but it's not an easy group. Like, those are not like particularly fun. It's not like Arsenal's group. Arsenal have got a weaker group than that.
Mm-hmm.
That's fairly tough, I think. In terms of like the away fixtures,
yeah,
though I would say overall it's like a relatively easy group because you probably expect to beat those teams when they come to you, but
you wouldn't be fuming if you're drawn in it. You wouldn't be like fuck, you'd be like, that's fine, like we can manage this. It's a comfortable group. It's not easy, but it's reasonably comfortable.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Manageable.
If you're the best team in it, then that's fine. And Inter are the best team in it, so they can't complain. But Lautaro Martinez has been absolutely on fire this season. He's got 12 goals in 12 in Serie A.
Last season too,
he's got another, last season, definitely. Another 2 in 4 in the Champions League. Thuram has got 9 in 12. The wing backs have both been flying. I think Dumfries and DiMarco have 5 and 6 goal involvements, respectively. So everything looks amazing. Got a great striker, great wing backs, a great kind of utility forward. Defense looks fantastic. Obviously, bringing in Pavard, great. They've got Acerbi, they've got Bastoni, they've still got De Frey. Like, they've got a lot of good pieces in defense. The only question, I think, is how solid is the midfield? Because obviously, Brozovic went to Saudi, and they basically just said, right, Çalhanoğlu is now going to play as a six. And he's been playing in central midfield alongside Henrik Mkhitaryan.
Which is kind of mental.
It's just worked.
But it's kind of mental when you think about it.
It's very weird. Like, it really is. Yeah. They're at like 7.3 tackles and interceptions between them a game, which is solid. But that said, Pavard still leads the squad in defensive action. So I was looking at that and I was like, huh.
Yeah, okay.
What this makes me think is the centre-backs are doing a lot, which means that the centre-backs are seeing quite a lot of traffic.
Mm-hmm.
Which means that against better players, they're probably going to get beaten.
Yeah.
Or against better players, they'll make a mistake and get a red card. Or if Çalhanoğlu and Mickey drop even slightly, that defence is suddenly going to be overwhelmed rather than just doing a lot. So it wouldn't be surprising to me if Inter look great, and then come up against like Bayern and just get absolutely pummeled, because I just don't know how solid... That midfield might be really good, But I defensively, I just have questions.
Neither of them are natural sixes, and I think you can get away with that against a lot of teams. But in a semi-final of the Champions League against a really good team that's in form in their stride,
yeah,
it's going to be a long night for them.
It would be one of those things where, like, okay, how do we win this game? Well, what happens is Pavard has like a Cannavaro at the World Cup type game. Like, we need one of our centre backs to just be absolutely unbeatable on this day. Like, because when your centre backs are doing this much work, then if they have an off day, you're fucked.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they have an okay day, you're kind of fucked.
Yeah,
if they have a good day, but your DMs don't have a good day, then you're fucked. Like, I mean, that basically everything needs to stay in perfect balance for things not to spin off their axis quite quickly. I'd also be intrigued to see them against just like a really physical side. Like, if they came up against like Newcastle, maybe they'd just pass it around Newcastle and be fine. They're certainly better than Newcastle in the stats, but
yeah, definitely.
It would sort of depend how they got reffed. Like, as in, if a ref lets teams kind of like hassle those midfielders and like push them around a bit, suddenly they're going to be in trouble. If they get protected, then it'll probably be okay. But you know what I mean? Like, there are all these questions. I think what could help them, though, is they're a good set piece side. I think they've already got 5 set piece XG in Serie A. Mm-hmm. And when you've got all those big centre backs, like, that is quite interesting. So I think that as they've also got, I think, the most direct attacks in Serie A. So you look at that and you think, huh, okay, well, how do they beat teams in the Champions League in the latter stages? Well, they play defensively, relying on their very good defenders. They support the sixes by dropping everybody 10 yards deeper, and they try and score from corners, free kicks and breakaways. And that's the plan. And
it's working.
It almost won them the Champions League final last season. That was how they played against City, and I thought they were fucking good. And
I didn't think that City weren't good in that final.
No, City weren't good. And I thought Pep just kind of got his tactics wrong, whereas for years when they haven't won the Champions League and everyone said he's got his tactics wrong, quite often I think he hasn't. He's been fine. But yeah, I don't know. Anyway, I think I'm intrigued to start seeing them against better teams. They've got Juve away when the international break's over. That'll be interesting. I'm intrigued to see them in the knockouts. But yeah, I'm quite bullish on Inter. Like, I'm really quite positive about them. Again, very brittle. You know, one of the wing-backs goes down or Martinez goes down, I think they're basically done. But if all those guys stay fit, but that's true of basically every team we're going to talk about. If X guy gets injured, that team's fucked. Like, what happens basically to, like, Bayern if Harry Kane gets injured? I mean, they probably cope better than Inter without Martinez, but it's a problem. So
yeah,
that's my take on Inter. I think there's a shot, and their numbers are genuinely as good as anybody's. Like, in the Champions League, they have been as good as they could possibly be. They're the second best team by expected goal difference per 90 in the Champions League. It goes City, Inter, Arsenal Football Club. So
is that the only reason you put that statistic in there? So you could just weasel Arsenal in there, third place?
Look, the Arsenal are where the Arsenal deserve to be, at the top of the global game.
Yeah.
Where are Man United?
Interesting.
You know who's good? You know who's actually sneaky good? Galatasaray.
They are.
Galatasaray, good man.
Well, we kind of knew that coming in anyway because of who they signed. And, like, they're just a fucking dangerous team.
Their squad is like play. They're like players you would have tried to sign 5 years ago.
Yeah. Like, it's genuinely just like kind of football managery, being like, it's pretty much exactly what I would do if I managed Galatasaray Football Manager. Who was good 5 years ago? Who was really good 5 years ago? Or never quite hit the peak that they thought they could, and we can get them for an affordable price. That's pretty much what they've done, and they've built a dangerous team. I don't think they'll go that far in the Champions League, but they will take scalps. And they're ready. They beat us at home. Like,
they were unlucky not to get more against Bayern Munich, where, like, they basically played them even. And if they could convert their chances, they could easily have drawn all one.
Whoever they come up against, they will be a problem. I'm pretty sure now that we lost to Copenhagen in that fucking ridiculous game, we need to go away to Galatasaray and win.
To have any chance.
And then I think we'll also
wants to go away to Galatasaray and do anything.
And we'll probably need to get something against Bayern at home. But at that stage, they're already qualified at top. Maybe not yet. Yeah,
I don't think it would necessarily be the worst thing for your United squad, to not, given the injury situation, to go out also like, just bottom and not have Europa League.
Given the fucking quality situation, probably best.
Sure. But imagine if you ended up in the Europa, that would be a nightmare.
Yeah, because then you would have it's pretty much the same as last. Anytime we drop into the Europa League, it's like, we probably should be winning this. Even though we're shit, the mentality is like, we probably should be winning this.
I know, it's got Liverpool in it this season.
Yeah, fair point, yeah.
Right, I mean, Liverpool might just thump him. Anyway, look, we're talking about contenders for the Champions League, so I don't know why we're talking
contenders
about
for the maybe
Manchester
Europa League.
United. Yeah. We might as well, Manchester United got as much chance of winning the Champions League as they have of winning, like, Ligue 1. So, who are your dark horses?
Do you want to know what Opta's prediction percentage is that Manchester United will win the Champions League? Can you guess?
Oh my God. Okay. Well, they're probably not going to get out of the group, so it's probably giving them... Okay, so I'm going to guess it's giving you like 8% chance or something of getting out of the group. Maybe more. Maybe it's giving you like 15.
Okay, this isn't getting out of the group.
I'm gonna,
winning the whole thing.
I know,
oh,
I'm
going backwards.
I know, okay. I'm going to work from there. Sure. So it'll probably be, let's just half, I guess. So, So is this to get to the final or to win it?
This is to win it. I can give you all of these numbers.
Oh, it'd be like 0.4%
to win it.
Yeah,
0.18.
That was not bad.
0.2%, pretty close.
Pretty good. a fifth of 1%.
0.6% to reach the final, 2% to reach a semi-final, and 8% to reach a quarterfinal. Not looking good, boys.
That's kind of not bad. They're giving you a 1 in 12 chance of reaching the quarterfinal from bottom of the group with two games left, away to Galatasaray and home to Bayern. Like, fucking hell. We're still talking about Man United. How's this happened? Right. Tell me about your dark horse.
My dark horse is a little bit more rogue, but in my head, actually, maybe not my head, in my gut, it makes sense. This is a feeling. So my dark horse is Napoli.
Oh, Jesus. Same feeling as my barber. He's like, my friend. It's happening.
Yeah. So on the one hand, it seems weird to be putting a team that dominated Serie A last year and won the league by 16 points as dark horses. On the other hand, it seems weird to be putting a team that has just sacked their manager after 16 games as a dark horse, or saying that they could go deep in the Champions League. And pretty much everybody has written them off. Nobody, you know, if you look, all of those stats we went through there on the big tangent, Napoli are pretty fucking low. I think they got a 2% chance to win the whole thing, according to Opta. But for me, I just can't look past them as much as others are looking past them, because I see them and I think they are kind of like a sleeping giant suffering from a champions hangover, a Scudetto winning hangover. And they've had a pretty weird season so far. So basically, they're the same team as last year, minus Kim Min-jae, who is a big loss.
Mm-hmm.
Like, undoubtedly, he's Serie A Defender of the Year. He's a big loss, but that is what it is. Outside of that, they're pretty much the same team. They lost Herbert Lozano to PSV, but he started like 10 games since January. I think he started 10 games in Serie A out of 23, 24 available. So I don't think that is a huge loss. Like, Kim Min-jae is a huge loss. But outside of that, they're pretty much the same team as last year, which won Serie A by 16 points, should have reached the Champions League final. Realistically, they'd be kicking themselves that they weren't playing City in that final, in my opinion.
They were crap.
They were crap, but based on their form coming into those teams, they should have.
But against, like, they were so bad against Milan, I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, sure, but before that game, you're looking at their route to the final being like, Napoli should navigate this to the final, and you would be disappointed as a Napoli fan to have gone out in the quarters the way they did. And yeah, obviously Spalletti left. They got in Rudy Garcia from Sardi. They've sacked him.
Crap.
Yeah, I mean, he looked completely out of his depth. Also, all of the gaffes he made, about Osman's approach from Sardi was that nobody good goes to Sardi. It's like a retirement league or whatever. Something to that effect. Not seeing the irony
not
that
wrong.
Is exactly where he fucking came from. He came from Al Nassr.
He's not fucking wrong, mate.
He's not wrong, but the fact that he's saying that and not seeing the irony
isn't that what they used to call like the Washington DC gaffe, which is that you fuck up by telling the truth. So it's just like he fucked up by saying something that everyone knows to be the case, but you're not meant to say if you're fucking coaching in Saudi, you dipshit. Yeah.
So he's obviously gone.
The idea of a manager managing Napoli and saying the league that you hired me from is such a pub league. Oh, he's such an idiot. I hate Rudy Garcia so much. He's an absolute oaf.
But sure, oh, he is gone. Walter Mazzari's back 10 years. 10 years after he left, or about that, 10, 11 years. 7-month contract. Conte seems to be coming in next year. That
should have got Potter.
That's the real green Potter. Imagine Potter in Napoli.
Potter, shirt off.
Like, after 50, like, shout, bright white.
Saying like, we're going to win the fucking Champions League. And all the Napoli fans firing flares into the Bay of Naples.
Stealing his car and shit. Yeah, fucking.
Sick.
But yeah, like, it's a bit of a weird season. It's a bit of a weird situation at Napoli right now. The manager they've got in is pretty much a glorified temporary manager. There seems to be no intention of this being a long-term thing. Not even a long-term thing. Not a thing that's not next season. Doesn't exist next season. Rumours are that Conte is being set up to come in next season. So the situation they have is a bit weird. They've come out of this amazing season last year with largely the same squad. They've already kind of ruined it. They've already failed to live up to the expectations of last season. Like, they've already come down from that in the fact they've sacked their manager after 16 games and everything's been a little bit underwhelming. So in a way, the worst has already happened in terms of the expectations, in terms of the pressures. And their underlying numbers aren't that bad. You know, they're second in the league for expected goals, second for expected goal difference per 90, seventh in Europe for expected goal difference per 90, third for expected points, less than 3 points behind Inter. But then in actual points, they're fourth and 10 back. So in many ways, there's a little bit of misfortune or fortune for both Inter and Napoli, depending on how you want to look at it. Like, that table could very much be different and much, much closer based on the underlying numbers, which is just how football works, and that's fine. But all these numbers are kind of pretty decent for a team that's just sacked their manager. And also, weirdly, it felt like he should have been sacked sooner. But for me, all of this kind of points to them being a sleeping giant, because they've still got Osimhen, they've still got Kvaratskhelia, they've got Laporta, they've got Anguissa, Zielinski, Politano. They've got all of these players that shot them to this amazing Scudetto win last year. And they're just not really playing that well. Like, well, they are and they're not. Like, Osimhen has had obviously issues with injuries, as well as his own social media team mocking him and the kind of fallout that happened around that. But of the 7 games he started, sorry, he's only started 7 of the 12 league games, but he's got 6 goals in 618 minutes. So he's averaging a goal every 103 minutes currently. And if you look at him last year, 26 league goals, was incredible last season. That meant that he was averaging a goal every 99 minutes. So he's pretty much there or thereabouts, 4 or 5 minute difference in terms of how often he's converting than he was last season. So he's kind of still got that ability, got that form to influence the game in that way, at that level, at that consistency. Issues are if he can get fit and stay fit, which I don't think should be too big a problem. Certainly not as big a problem as like a Pedri, for example. And his 0.54 XG per 90 isn't amazing, but it is second behind Martinez. Like, he's second in the league, and Kvaratskhelia is third with 0.5. So him coming back, him playing more minutes, like I said, he's only played about 600 minutes, him playing more minutes, Napoli all of a sudden get quite a bit better. And the Mazzari appointment, in a way, for me, and this is where the gut comes in, I think it could be a good thing for them, because he's not long-term. He pretty much did nothing. He was on the up when he left Napoli last time. He was meant to go on and do great things and has kind of pretty much done nothing. Inter, Watford, whatever. He's pretty much failed in every role he's been in the last 10 years. So he's coming in with, like, he's very malleable. He's very pliable to the Napoli way, how Napoli want to use him as an institution. He's a 3-5-2 manager, but he's not going to play a 3-5-2 because Napoli aren't set up to play 3 at the back. So he's not going to be playing his version of football, which for me means that he's going to have to look at his squad, assess his best players, who are our game changers, and then set up a team to maximize that and not have any, like, not have that moment where you're like, okay, we're coming in, you're a really good footballer, but now I want you to do this. I want you to play this way. I want you to tweak your game to suit this system. He's pretty much just got to, he's already said that he's going to adapt, and he's pretty much just got to pick his best squad and in its most functional format. And in a tournament like the Champions League, for me, that kind of feels like it's set up for short-term success, or at least gives them the best chance of short-term success.
Yeah, it's not bad, is it?
Like, for me...
Like, basically, get the boys up for it
them play.
And just, like, let them go out there.
Yeah, like, yeah. All of the pressures have been dispelled from last season, or in terms of...
just let the boys play.
Really, yeah, literally. I think I've made a point, just let the fucking boys play.
Let the fucking boys play.
Basically... All of the kind of pressures from maintaining last season's form have kind of been dispelled because they've not been as good and they've already sacked a manager. They've brought in a manager short term and they've pretty much got the same squad that was so successful last year. This, for me, if I'm in that squad, I'm thinking this is a pretty free swing. The rest of the season is a bit of a free swing. You don't need to be concerned with how you're playing in terms of how you fit a system, how you change your game, how do I get minutes. You're like, if you're playing well, you'll get on that pitch, pretty much. If you're a game changer, you'll get on that pitch. And for me, with the quality that they have, individually, Osimhen, Carvajal has been amazing. Well, he's been incredible for them. Napoli have kind of been pretty underwhelming so far in the Champions League, but Carvajal has been their best player by far. You know, he's played pretty much every minute. He leads the tournament in chances created alongside Grealish. He's second for chances created from ball carrying. Second for attempted take-ons with like a significantly higher success percentage than all of the other players with over 30 attempts. Like, he has been their shining light in the Champions League so far. Add Osimhen back fit and scoring. Like, when Osimhen's been on the pitch, he's scoring pretty much at the same rate he scored in an incredibly successful season last year. So put him on the pitch with Cavardeschella in a team that is just going out and playing freely and being like, you know what, we're just going to fucking play. Like, we're good. The manager supports that. All he needs to do is be a decent man manager, motivate them, get them on his side, and get them kind of in a functional format that amplifies their greatest parts the most. And I don't think that's that difficult to do. You kind of look back at, like, Zidane at Madrid, those Champions Leagues he won. Those weren't tactical masterclasses. Those are just being a really good man manager of really, really good talent. Yeah. So whether... he's good enough to do that. Whether Mazzarri's good enough to do that, who knows? But
spoiler alert, he is not.
But he doesn't need to be.
He might be.
He doesn't need to be an Ancelotti with tactics. He doesn't need to be rework players and play fucking their number 10 and left back.
He can Harry Redknapp it.
He can just be like.
He can Redknapp it.
Osimhen, centre forward, score us loads of goals. Cavardeschella, be really good on the wing and create loads of chances.
Just go out there and have fun.
All the other guys, like, just fucking shore up the fence and don't be shit. is a good squad.
To be honest, he does kind of need to get, like, let them manage themselves and do some vibes.
Like, that is a good squad. Individually, they have the ability to go deep in the Champions League. And this kind of is a soft reset in the middle of the season that kind of frees them up. And I think it'll be exciting to see them. It could be a train wreck. Like, I think it'll either be a train wreck or it'll be great. I don't think there's much
but
in between.
They could be, in a way, they can be a poor man's Real Madrid.
Yeah.
In that it's like, basically park everyone behind the ball and be like, Osimhen, Kvaratskhelia,
do something.
Let's see what happens.
Yeah.
And, you know, neither one of those was particularly spectacular in the knockout stages last season. But all it takes is like Kvaratskhelia to go like supernova for 45 minutes. And suddenly you're like, oh shit, we're in the semi.
Yeah.
And then, like, you know, everybody in Napoli like takes the fucking invincibility star from Super Mario and like, you know, the Champions League anthem starts like blasting out of like Mount Vesuvius.
and
they're just killing people.
Fucking hell. In a weird way, we spoke about how Barcelona needed Pedri to be good. I kind of feel that like that's more difficult than what it takes for Napoli to be good. I kind of feel based on that scenario versus Napoli scenario, there's a really decent chance that they just become deep. They just become a really difficult side to beat in the Champions League, like a really good attacking side that plays with freedom. And they're big sleeping giant.
I would rather have, we'd rather have Osimhen and Kvaratskhelia than like Lewandowski and Pedri because you just have no certainty that Pedri will be fit.
Well, yeah. Okay. I would prefer Lewandowski and Pedri if Pedri could be fit all the time. But the biggest...
Yeah, except that with Lewandowski and Pedri, you're kind of like, well, Pedri can create something out of nothing.
Yeah.
Lewandowski is obviously an amazing fit, but he's going to have to get some service. Whereas, like, at least Osimhen can, like, run. you know, like run the length of the pitch and so could quite outscale it. But anyway, yeah, I'm just saying that like when you factor in fitness, you'd rather have those two because like especially playing counter-attacking football in the Champions League. But anyway, enough of that. Enough of that. If you want to hear our opinions on Arsenal and Bayern Munich, then head over to the paid side. Subscribe for $6 a month. You get an extra 2 episodes. Thank you very much to all the people who have newly subscribed. Make sure to send in your questions. We've had a couple of good ones this week, but this topic ended up being so meaty that we had to split it over both episodes. So let's move on to the bump. Okay, burn book time, Pete, as always. Dealer's choice. What do you want? Do you want to do in? Do you want to do out?
Am I the dealer? Because I feel like you're dealing. In which case, the dealer's choice, it would be your choice.
No, I'm letting you deal.
You're letting me deal. Okay.
Yeah. Put on your waistcoat.
I would like, okay.
And deal the cards.
Based on the waistcoat
reference.
Oh, on
that topic, sorry, before we get onto this, how's your father-in-law's waistcoat coming along? Like, what's happening?
I'm actually not sure. I've just realised that I never actually replied to him. 2 weeks ago.
Oh, fuck.
You've just made me realize I didn't reply to him. I'll reply to him after this and find out.
It's going to be so.
Stay tuned to find out in 2 weeks' time.
Oh, yeah. All right. Well, fine.
The father of the bride suit is going. However, very topically, I will then choose to put something in the burn book because what I want to put in the burn book this week are black tie weddings.
So. I agree over the past, so strongly with this.
Over the past few weeks, probably about a month, I have been in the market to get my wedding suit. And I've got multiple places in London, a couple of places in Belfast as well, looking to get, I guess, a really lovely suit made to measure that is really lovely and will be not only be great on the wedding day, but be really useful going forward. And like a really nice thing to keep. And it's like the exact opposite of a wedding dress that you can only wear once. Like, I want to wear this for a lot of other special occasions and be like, this is my wedding suit. And it's also a really good suit. Yeah. And in terms of colorings and that, I'm generally going towards the green hues, greens and olives.
Yes.
I think it's just my complexion. I think it is a little bit more interesting. It's not as seen as the blacks or the grays or the navies. So for me, my wedding suit is meant to be a suit, but also like more than a suit, like a special suit, you know, like not punchy, but like it's a little bit different. It's a little bit more like standoutish. Yeah. I want it to be.
You spend a bit more on it than you normally would. And you get something that's a little bit more like peacocky than you would normally.
Yeah, exactly. And I've gone into a lot of places and some of them have been great, but then some of them have just been the most bland, flat, boring suits I've ever seen in my life. And a lot of them have kind of looked like work suits, which I get. There's a place for them. They're simple, they get the job done. But the more I kind of researched it, the more I kind of looked for inspiration for my wedding suit, the more I saw how common it was that people get married in black tie, tuxedo, black bow tie, white shirt, whatever. And I just think it's so, one, impersonal, and two, boring, and three, American. It's a very American thing.
Well, I was going to say, like, when you say you see people doing it, you mean you see Americans?
No. So historically it was, but I've seen so many people who...
I'm sorry, but a wedding is not a black tie event.
It's not.
It's not a black tie event.
Like...
It's morning dress or suits or casual. Those are your options.
I see so many people, like British people, Irish people, Northern Irish people now, who I've either known or they're friends of friends or they just pop up my social whatever. And I see them and it's like, the groom's party or black tie. And it's just, you're wearing a black tux. And, you're wearing a black tux too. And everybody's fucking wearing a black tux. Boring. Mm. It's just like a school uniform. You're merging into obscurity. There's nothing.
I would say you can do stuff with black tie.
Yeah, but they never do. They're just like, we're getting married. What do we do? Oh, black tie's fancy. That, you know.
And they don't even wear like proper shirts with studs.
Yeah.
Like it's just like a normal,
like a normal shirt where you can see the buttons. Yeah.
Mental. That gets on my tits, man. I'm just like, no. Or they wear the wing collars, which are not
black tie.
Appropriate
not black tie.
With black tie. Exactly.
White tie.
Thank you. I agree. And look, if you want to have a white tie wedding, I'm all for that. That's white tie is
different.
Sick.
Sure.
White tie
agree.
Is the best, but also if you're if you have suits at your wedding, everybody is going to be wearing suits in the congregation. If you have morning dress, I think it's okay for the groom's party to be wearing morning dress and the congregation to have a mix of morning dress and normal suits. But if the groom's party are wearing black tie,
everybody else
is not wearing black tie,
you're looking at it.
That's going to look stupid. Everyone has to wear black tie for black tie to look good.
Yeah,
I think it needs to be a sea of black tie.
Exactly right. Because I was at an award ceremony, sports broadcast awards, like 2 weeks ago, last week, whatever. Black tie event. I refused.
Wasn't invited.
It absolutely wasn't. Olivia Dodd got a last minute call up. She turned it down.
I thought you were going to say she got an award, and I was going to worst newcomer, Olivia Dodd. R.I.P. She was in the in memoriam section.
Best over 30. Yeah. But that event was black tie. And I refused to wear black tie because black tie has been bastardized at those events, because I know for a fact half the people there will be wearing an award ceremony.
It's not formal.
But also half the people there will be wearing black tie. Half the people there will be wearing fucking trainers with a suit. Behave yourselves. Yeah. Like I am
or
not...
Or they think black tie is a black suit with a bow
tie. With a black tie. Or, yeah. I am not being complicit in the bastardization of black tie or sartorial propriety. I'm not being complicit in the bastardization of that. So I just wore a jacket and trousers with a tie in rebellion. However,
do you remember the month where you and I were like completely like despised at FD because
everybody else went
to an awards show and they were all like showing us what they were wearing, and you and I were like, you all look like fucking idiots. Yeah. And then they were even Zach was cross with us, and Zach's like never been cross with me in his life, but they were all just like, why do you keep talking shit about what we're wearing? And we were like, because you're wearing like a burgundy suit. You're wearing a fucking like polo neck.
A fucking chessboard. Yeah.
Underneath your check suit. You look like you're all dressing.
No socks and loafers and shit. Yeah.
Oh my God. Like dressing like shit you've seen on Instagram. Just wear a normal suit, like a normal man, and be dignified. And everyone fucking hated us.
I stand by it. But yeah.
We were right.
We are. Absolutely. But yeah, black tie weddings, boring. There is zero character. When you look back on it, you'll just look like everybody else. There is nothing of note to black tie. I like black tie. I think it's elegant and it's lovely. It's just boring.
Yeah, it's great.
And there's a reason why it's boring, and that's why it's elegant. It's simple and it's understated. That is not for your wedding day. Stop trying to be fancy by having a black tie wedding. Having a black tie wedding doesn't make you fancier. Doesn't make the day fancier. Just stop it. We're not American.
Look.
Well, I'm sure there are a lot of Americans here. But also Americans have evening weddings.
We're not American, Pete.
I know. I think... Americans have their weddings later as well, which I suppose kind of makes it slightly more acceptable because it's evening wear technically. However, still, don't have a black tie wedding. You can get a really interesting, really lovely suit that you'll cherish for much longer, and you will look back in your pictures in 20 years being like, I look fucking sick there. Whereas if you look back on a black tie wedding in 20 years, you'd be like, I look like I could be at a award ceremony. I look like I could be at a wedding. I look like I could be anywhere, any black tie event ever. And that's a bit depressing for me. So black tie weddings in the bin.
Oh, I completely agree. Honestly as well, like this idea of like dressing nicely, dressing in a fancy way, only works if you do it well.
Mm.
Like honestly, if you're wearing a t-shirt and jeans and trainers, you can look smarter than somebody in black tie if they're doing it really sloppily and badly and you've chosen what you're wearing and it all fits you.
Yeah.
Because that's the other thing. Like I just hate seeing black tie where I'm like, this is an elastic like bow tie, this is a normal white shirt, these are just normal black trousers, you know, without like the silk strip down the side. Mm-hmm. Like this person's just wearing like some like shit flicker like crap black shoes that haven't been polished. Like just do it properly. That said, I would like to go to a black tie event because like I never get to wear my dinner jacket, so anyway, whatever. It's a very good one. It's a really, really good one. What I'm putting in, I've got to check with you that I haven't already put this in because I know I've ranted about this to other people and I want to make sure I haven't ranted about it here. Do you know who the hardest geezer is?
Hardest geezer? Is that the guy running through Africa?
Yes.
I know who he is. I don't believe you put this in the burn book before.
Okay, good. This guy is a fucking idiot. He's an idiot. Like, he's running the length of Africa for charity. Great. He's not really running the length of Africa. He's actually running more than the length of Africa because he's running up the West Coast, which is a great choice on his part. But basically, he's running like 60K a day, every day. And it's going to take months. So that is bananas. Like, it's a physical feat. It's very impressive. It's going to raise money for charity. Good stuff. But he seems to literally have no idea what the fuck he's doing. Like, after about a month of him doing this, he was like, oh, I've been pissing blood the last 3 days. Yeah. Like, better go and get myself checked out by the doctor, and then I'll get back to stomping tarmac tomorrow. And I was like, you might have rhabdomyolysis. Like, what are you doing? This is, like, dangerous stuff. And he just, like, pisses blood for 3 days, you know, runs 30K one day instead of 60K, and then gets back to it. And everybody underneath is just like, oh, legend, legend. Oh, he's so amazing, isn't he? He's like, no, he's a fucking idiot. And then that's before we get to my main issue with him, which is that he seems to have no conception of how dangerous some of the places he's running through are. And he kind of treats it as a joke. And he does often say stuff where I'm like, don't say that. Like, so I think he was in Congo at one point, and he was like, I got separated from my support van. And anyway, he ended up like coming across some guys on a moped, and they were like, we were sent to get you. And he got on their moped, and then he got taken to a village, and he was like, yeah, a bunch of guys with like machetes turned up and were debating what to do with me and asked for my money, and I didn't have any money. And eventually I just like ran off into like the forest to try and get away from them. And I was like, like, this sounds like bullshit, but if it's not bullshit, if it's true, you're the world's thickest man. Did you not know that the DRC is very, very dangerous? It's not dangerous like the way that, you know, your mum will say to you, oh, you know, you'll say, oh, I went to a gig in Brixton, and she'll be like, oh, Brixton, I've heard Brixton's very dangerous. And you're like, it's not, it's a completely normal part of London. Like, it's not dangerous like that. The Democratic Republic of Congo is fucking dangerous.
Yeah.
And so are quite a few countries down the west coast of Africa. And if somebody says that to you and you ignore it, that doesn't mean that, like, the person you're talking to is, like, a racist who thinks Africa is dangerous. There are lots of Africa. He also ran through Namibia. Namibia, not dangerous. Completely fine. A lot of countries, you can't just, like, run through like a fucking idiot without preparing. And he's constantly like, oh, yeah, we had to fly back to, like, Luanda to sort out our visas for the next stage of the trip, and then fly back to the place that I last got to on my run so that I could start from there again. But I was just like, this guy has not planned what he's doing at all. And I was talking to an ex-army guy I know, and telling him about this, and he was just like kind of raging about it, because he was just like, do you realize how often, like, in the army you get, there are like, people do get calls where they're like, we've got to send a team in to like rescue this person who's got themselves fucking kidnapped.
Yeah.
He was like, I know of like this one German nun who's been kidnapped like 5 times in Congo.
Because, and eventually they've
like, yeah, she's like a missionary. And they were like, they rescued her like 3 or 4 times. And eventually they were like, we're going to lose somebody on one of these trips. And she keeps just going back. So like, fuck her. Like, sorry, you can't keep going to dangerous places and getting kidnapped and expecting to get rescued. And that is kind of what I think with this guy. I'm like, firstly, he's just cavalier about his health in a way that I don't think is like, quote unquote, legendary, because I'm not a fucking 15-year-old. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's like, I just think he doesn't know what the fuck he's doing. And that isn't like impressive, and it isn't like adventurous. It's silly. There are parts of the world that you should steer clear. Like, don't go to the Darien Gap, you know? Like, don't be one of those people who tried to like smuggle themselves into Iraq so that they could fight with the Kurds. Like, don't do that. It's fucking stupid. You don't know what you're doing. And so with this guy, I was just like, you don't know what you're doing. You're a moron. And it's actually staggering that you're not dead. And when he gets to the end of it, assuming he gets to the end of it, he'll be like, this is amazing. Like, don't let anybody ever tell you you can't do something. But it's like, no, you need to understand how lucky you got here. That like, on another day, the wrong people kidnap you. And they're not people who want like $50 from your teammates. They want to fucking behead you. And like, that does happen in the Democratic Republic of Congo quite a lot. And it happens in quite a lot of places around the world. Quite a lot. And if you steam into those places with no idea what the fuck you're doing, then you are putting your life on the line. So it just annoys me. It just annoys me seeing everybody like underneath him being like, oh my God, legend. Like, you know, as we speak, he is pissing blood somewhere in Africa.
Yeah,
because I saw the thing today where I was like, oh, you're pissing blood again, are you, fella? Like, do you know what? That's the God's way of telling you that you're a fucking moron, but when also, blood is coming out of your fucking penis. stop running.
I think we're talking about the same video because I saw that this week at some point. I can't remember on what platform, but it just popped up because I'm pretty sure I don't follow him. I think it just popped up somewhere. And it showed he had taken a video on his phone that he kind of flashed to the camera of the pee stream. And I assumed it would be like slight, like most like normal pee, but like, which is like a tinge. It was like fully bright red or like bright.
Oh, God.
It was like so densely colored with
I did not watch that.
With blood. And I was like, that is like not even a little bad. That is like fucked. So like, that's
God.
And then like 2 days after that, he took 2 days off because he was like in an immense amount of pain and went and got like back scans and shit, like x-rays of his back to check if nothing was broken. And turns out nothing was broken, but his response was, I got the most powerful painkillers from them I could. I've taken them and now I'm back to running.
Yeah.
Which again is absolutely dumb because you're masking
the pain.
And
everyone underneath is like, lad. Everyone underneath is like, you're such a lad. Like, gee, keep going, Don. Fuck off.
You're using like stupid, immensely strong medicine to numb the pain so you can continue running.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That's just, in what world is that just going to get better?
I know. What is his plan? But similarly, yeah, like when dumb. It was really, really hot, he was running through the heat and again was kind of like, oh, pretty hot out there today. But you know, you keep going, don't you? And you're just like, this again, I think, is such an English attitude where people have no idea how dangerous heat is. Like, I think people in countries that are not hot are like, well, you know, it's just hot, isn't it? And they don't realize that like people die in the heat all the time and not like old people. Like, I remember Emma and I were watching a documentary a few years ago where this guy was like walking through part of Central Africa and he was just like made some friends and he was walking with them. One of these guys was like in his 40s. He was like an American journalist and they were walking along. They were like, it's really hot. They're all wearing hats. They're all drinking water, but they were like, it's really, really hot. And then this guy collapsed. And the next thing was like the presenter doing a piece to camera. And he was like, so that guy's just died. Like it was, he just got hot. His body temperature went up. And essentially, like, his organs failed and he died.
Yeah.
And people who really live in heat don't do the shit that English people do when they're like, oh, I just love going out, like, in the heat and getting super sunburned and just, like, I'm a sun worshipper, me. People who actually live in hot places are like, no, the sun is, like, an enemy
they stay
to
away
managed.
From it. Yeah,
like, the sun is a fucking dangerous thing. And just this guy being so cavalier and not just with his own well-being but with other people's, and the fact that he's being cheered on by a crowd of fucking morons like who think that this is like, you know, funny and like adventurous and cool when actually it's just an ignorant man trying to do something which other people don't do because it requires a high level of stupidity to attempt. I just, every time I see him it infuriates me, and Emma's always like, please unfollow this man, he makes you angry.
Well, you still follow him.
But I was like, I'm just waiting for the day that, you know, like they post like a black screen and they post a black screen and they're just like, oh, like,
it wouldn't be a black screen. It'd be a black and white photo of him.
The hottest geezer today, like, oh, he tried to have a shifty at like a snake that he found on the side of the road and it fucking bit him and his blood turned into fucking like gravy, like the stupid bastard. And now he's fucking dead. Moron. Next level moron. But anyway, yeah, great. Doing it for charity. Fucking honestly. If you're gonna do something for charity, you should force your elderly father to do laps of your garden to fund the NHS. that's a charity. And then
set up a charity and siphon money off to fucking fund your own lifestyle and buy a jacuzzi and a fucking Rolex.
I'm sorry, they are my favorite people on earth. They are my favorite people on earth. I absolutely love that family. Unironically, I have a friend where we just send each other like Captain Tom, like pictures of him, like,
oh my God,
like on a rainbow or something, but it's just ridiculous. It kills me. Anyway, sorry. Went too long on that. What are we taking out of the burn book, Pete?
Okay. So what I'm going to take out of the burn book this week, I had a couple of options and I'm actually yet to decide. I'm going to decide right now. Okay, what I'm going to take out of the burn book this week is Black Friday.
Yeah, so yeah, boy.
I think Black Friday.
You know what? My Black Friday list has
the air fryer.
I'm watching the air fryer's price tick down day by day.
Yeah,
it's 32% discounted right now. So
delightful.
We should have an affiliate link.
But yeah, I think Black Friday kind of gets a bit of a bad rap in a lot of people are like, oh, the companies are like shifting their unwanted stock for cheap prices. And like, why would you buy that when there's like loads of newer models, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that is an argument that you could make. But generally speaking, what they're doing is they're taking things that are like maybe 1 or 2 years old, still brand new, and selling them at like half price. And even though there are 1 or 2 newer models, that doesn't immediately mean that the model they made 2 years ago is now absolute trash. Like a TV that is 2 or 3 years old is still going to be a good TV. If it was a good TV then and it's unused, it's still going to be a good TV now. It's just half the price of what it was when it came out 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 4 years ago. So other than like iPhones and I suppose like, actually not even like gaming consoles. The only reason I have a PS5 is because Jess got me one for free. Like pretty much all of my technology bar my phone is minimum, is purchased like at least 2 years old, 2 years after it comes out. Because I don't see the point in spending like full, unless this iteration of whatever the technology is has a seismic jump in technology, there is no point. If it's a TV, a smart TV from 4 years ago is going to be pretty similar to a smart TV from this year. They're going to have all the same apps. They're both unused. The only difference is that one is a significantly lower price. And the idea that just because something is now 3 years old, but still new, that means that it's bad or that not worth it is mental to me. So basically I just update. I use things like Black Friday to update my outdated, exclusively electronics almost, but update them with the model that is now 2 years old. And they work perfectly and it's a lovely system and you don't end up, you spend like 200 quid on a TV instead of 500 quid. And it's like, it just makes sense. So it's obviously a bit of a scam. You can, if you follow like price trackers, you can see that everybody inflates the price of their item before Black Friday. Mm-hmm. So then when they drop it, the discount seems greater.
Yeah.
Sure. That just play the game. That's fine. That's marketing. That's what they do. Fair enough. Cool. At the end of the day, you're getting a good product that might be a couple of years old, but it's unused and it's much cheaper than you would be paying for the newer version of it. And I really think that the differences between, in terms of performance and technology, etc., the differences between them are probably minimal. Like even with iPhones, the iPhone 14, whatever it is now, is pretty much, everyone's saying it's pretty much the same as the last one. And when that one came out, they said pretty much the same as one before it. So unless there's like a seismic jump in technology, there's no point buying something that is just released or it's like the latest version of something. Buy a couple years old, save money, you'll have the same experience. Black Friday's good. I'm looking forward to it. It's already started on Amazon.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I think you've got to have, I think you're right. I think you've just got to have the kind of, have the list of things that you've kind of been waiting to buy all year.
Mm.
And then you actually know whether you're getting a good deal or not.
Because you know the price.
And you can decide what to do about it, you know? So in a way, like we were saying this, like we're kind of fortunate that we're moving house right around Black Friday.
Yeah.
We're like, we need a new dining table. Great. We need some new chairs. Great. We want to get the air fryer. Great. Like, let's do all this shit and, you know, be kind of set up for it. Plus anything for the baby. Like, it's kind of, it's quite a nice,
We're also in the market.
I agree. Like,
we're also in the market for a dining table and chairs.
Really?
Be interested to compare notes.
Some suggestions.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
it would be good, actually. Yeah. I'm struggling today. Okay, I think that's a good one. My one, quickly. Emma and I watched The Killer on Netflix last weekend, which I've been looking forward to all year because I love David Fincher. It was okay. I didn't love it. It was okay. But soundtrack is pretty much exclusively The Smiths.
Okay.
It also actually has one of my top 10 songs of all time on it, which it had Glory Box by Portishead, one of the greatest songs ever written. But it's one of those things where I was like, oh, I don't really listen to The Smiths that much. I'm going to listen to The Smiths. And I think that was kind of necessary this week because recently we've been introducing my daughter to some more like classic Disney. Not really watching the films, but just playing the songs.
Just the scores.
And so...
Which one's featured? I'm very invested in this. I'm sorry. This is my fucking world.
This week it's been mostly like The Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast.
Okay, sure. Second one, better score than the first, but that's fine.
Yeah, of course. Like, I mean, but that said, I don't know, man. Like, that said, like, there are a couple of great songs in The Little
Part
Mermaid.
Of Your World
there
is
just
very good.
That many.
Part of Your World is very good, that's about it.
Yeah, though, Part of Your World is kind of underproduced. But it's weirdly a thin song. But exactly, Part of Your World, I've been walking around for the last couple of weeks just being like, what is a fire? Why does it, what's the word, burn? Like, and I was just like, I need to listen to music for a grown up. So it was kind of nice that I got reminded that I do like listening to the Smiths.
Yeah.
And I was just like, right, I can actually listen to the Smiths for a couple of days and try and clear these songs, which I love,
yeah,
out of my mind. But when you wake up in the middle of the night and you've got like a Disney song stuck in your head, it's insane. And I've only experienced that since having a child, where I'll wake up in the night and I'm like, I can't. You know, like that. You know the 20-minute like Frozen short films they make for Disney.
Yeah,
Plus
I've never watched any of them, but I know there's
fucking up. I've seen them. Seen them, and they fucking gargle balls. They suck. But like they all have songs in them, and then like you wake up in the night and you're just like, it's almost time to ring the bell. Like you just think like, I can't do it. I can't do it. Mm. So every now and then you need something to just like detox from like stultifying like Disney anthems. That said, when I picked baby up from nursery today and I was walking her home pushing the pram, and she said, want to sing Beauty and the Beast? And so I sang like Tale as Old as Time, and then she said, want to sing Be Our Guest? And so I was like, perfect, because I used to sing Be Our Guest to her when she was tiny. I've got a video of me performing it to her when she's like 3 months old. So that was fine. I was just like, I'll happily sing Be Our Guest as I walk along one of the busiest roads in my area at top volume to my daughter. Like, that's kind of fun. That's a great song. And she always tries to sing like the last word in every line, because she's trying to remember it as she goes. And then like it comes out of her mouth a little bit late, but she really likes to sing along. So anyway, I'm not talking about Disney, but the Smiths, great, you know. It's one of those things where you're just like, you know, sometimes there's a band where you're like, I like all this music. Every time I listen to it, I like it, but I never actually sit down and make an effort to listen to it for some reason.
Yeah,
I think sometimes it's worth just doing it.
She and Morrissey's such a prick, but you sure.
Yeah, Morrissey is a massive prick. Though that said,
separate the art from the artist.
The fact that they named an album Meat is Murder is just kind of amazing. Like, you have got to give that to him. At least they named it after that obsession of his, you know.
Sure, yeah.
He was
yeah.
like, right, okay, let's name it after vegetarianism rather than after the other thing I'm really interested in, which is immigration.
Yeah,
which I've got a big problem with. Yeah. Just loves racism. Yeah. So yeah, anyway. Loves racism, hated the Queen. So, you know, 50-50. Yeah. Anyway, that's enough of this. week. Okay, thank you very much for listening. We are going to continue our conversation about the Champions League over on the paid side. If you haven't subscribed, make sure that you do. If you do subscribe, then we really do appreciate it. Thanks very much. Like, I'm moving house, I've left a job, I've got another baby on the way. Like, please subscribe to this fucking podcast. And Pete needs money to buy himself a wedding suit, to buy himself a fancy green wedding suit.
Absolutely not black tie.
Yeah, so he looks like fucking Paddy Power. Not black tie under any circumstances. Okay, we will catch you on the other side. Thanks for listening. Bye.